Hey everybody, welcome back to episode 4 of the Rust is Gold Racing Podcast. We're here today with Rocker Ron Senna. He's going to talk to us a little bit about vintage motorcycles, specifically Yamahas, right? RD?
I love the Yamahas. The RDs. Yep.
Yep. Sparky,
yep.
Hollywood, and Rocker Ron. What's up, Sparky?
Not much, man. Just drinking some of this coffee, trying to wake up.
What do you think?
Oh, it's good.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Got some hair in your chest.
Oh, that espresso shot sure did.
Yeah, it's the Rust is Go coffee. Which one was it?
We're actually doing a Prosum blend right now, so it's a 50-50 Peru and Bolivia, so it's a good stuff.
Do I have the same thing?
No, you have a iced coffee.
I know, but what's the
not
blend?
From Prosum, no.
You give me the cheap stuff?
It's a secret, yeah. It won't put hair in your chest, though.
What's up, Hollywood? What's going on?
Another hard day at the shop, getting ready to open, getting ready for a couple events coming up. Happy to see Ronnie in the house. Good to see this guy.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Ronnie, tell us a little bit about your motorcycle background.
Oh, that's a long story. I was legally riding since I was 13 with my restricted license, which I got taken away for a year. It was the most agonizing year ever, right?
You losing
it after away? I got 13 tickets, dude.
I believe this knowing
this,
you.
This freaking cop had no sense of humor at all. He had to go get a new ticket book out of it. He was on a motorcycle too, so he knew, man. He got me for every infraction you could imagine, right?
How old were you?
14.
Wow,
14. I was waiting to turn 16. At 16, you get your full endorsement, right?
Uh-huh.
And at that point, then I could ride anything, right? But I was riding dirty because I was on a little Honda 100, and it was really, technically, it was over the horsepower limit that I should have been on, but what the hell, you know?
Was that here in Albuquerque?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're native?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Born and raised here. Yeah.
Riding, I'm sure back then, riding the Arroyos in the ditches. And
oh, dude, that's how we ditched the cops. To be perfectly honest with you, that's how we did. I could show you this places to, well, almost now it's all full of houses, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I could have showed you the places. They, yeah, it was easy. Yeah. We'd just ditch off into the Arroyo and bye-bye.
When did you start getting into the RDs?
I got into the RDs after I turned 16. And I started squirreling away some money, and it's like, I need a bigger bike. I need to keep up. All my friends are getting Honda 500s. You know, the 750 had come along, and it was a real popular bike, the CB750. And I'm burning it up on this little 100 trying to keep up with the guys, right? So I need a bigger bike. And I really didn't know much about it at the time, but I saw this ad. This guy had this. It was actually an R5, 350 for sale, and it was like $800 or something like that, or no, it was even less than that. It was maybe six, right? It was something that I was able to squirrel away and go buy this thing, okay? So I go down, I had a friend drop me off. So I go down, I buy this thing, and I'm driving it, and I had to drive cautiously because he's got this long dirt driveway.
Right.
But as soon as I get it on the pavement, I'm like, well, let's see what this thing will do, right? Well, hot shot on my little 100, right? I cranked the throttle, and the front end came straight up in the air, dude. I puckered up like it scared the living bejesus out of me, and I was like all the way home terrified, going, you're in over your head. No, you'll get used to it. No, you're in over your head. No, you'll get used to it. And eventually, I did get used to it. Right?
That was your first time on a two-stroke.
And that was my first time on a two-stroke.
And that's your first time hitting power band, I guess.
Yeah, power band.
Yeah, it was the first all the way around. Scared the hell out of me, man.
Everybody remembers their first power band. Mm-hmm.
It was
right?
Terrifying. It was terrifying.
Yeah, and that R5 is what, 70, 71?
That was a 70.
70, yeah.
The one that I bought was a 1970.
Is that, I have that R3 that's a 69, and yeah. The R5 was the next one.
Yeah.
Give us a little bit of a little history of the RD, you know, like what makes it special? Because RD guys that are into RDs freaking love RDs.
Right. When we go out on a ride, you know, you'll see CB guys, Honda guys all day long. But there's always one or two guys that look at Ronnie's bike and say, oh, I remember that bike when I was 16, right?
Mm-hmm. True.
Every single place we go to, somebody always comes out and pinpoints Ronnie's bike.
They always come up and they go, oh, man, I had a friend back in the day and he let me ride it. That was blah, 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 right? Yeah, I get that all the time. What's special about them is they're so lightweight and nimble, and they really were made for good handling. They weren't like the Kawasaki triple that was in a straight line, you're okay, but try and turn, you're going to die, right? And the Suzukis were powerful, but they governed them down. They doggied them down, right? The RD was just this little light animal,
right?
And Yamaha, over the years, what they did from the R5, they were torque inducted. They later on, they ended up putting the reed valves in to tone them down.
No.
People don't realize that. And then later on, they came out with the 400. And the 400 was another attempt to tone the bike down, to get it to act more like a four-stroke, which it's never going to do. But they did actually succeed pretty well in the 400. What they did is it's the same bore, but they extended the stroke, right? So it's not as torquey as a 350. Well-tuned will whoop a 400's butt all day, every day. Yeah, just because they're torquey.
Have you been on the RD ever since, or did you switch it up throughout the years?
Oh, at one point I had a Yamaha LTD. It was the 750, XS750. And that thing was a blast, you know, because it would just, power on. I could rip that thing 120 down the freeway. Yeah, it was fun. And I was getting crazy with it, going through a divorce, and it's like I gotta get rid of this thing, man. I'm drinking too much and going too fast. It's like I'm gonna die on this thing if I don't get rid of it. So I did, and after that, I just wanted another bike. I wanted another bike, but I didn't want to settle for just anything. You know what I mean? What I really, really wanted deep down was another RD. And I got a phone call. This guy's got like four RDs, and he'll let them all, the whole thing go for $400. And I'm like,
what?
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. So that's
all running?
Oh, no. They were all basket cases.
Oh, they were all basket cases.
And this is where you got Cody's.
Cody's,
Michelle's,
and my
bike.
Yeah.
What happened to the fourth?
It's still there, waiting for me to come and take care of it. Yeah.
Now, Michelle's your wife.
Yeah.
And you've modified her RD as well.
Yeah.
And is Cody's stock, or did you?
Oh, no. Cody's is just like mine. This is cafe'd out.
Yeah. Well, talk about that a little bit. I mean, how did you get into the idea of, like, making a cafe racer out of your bikes?
You know, that's a tough one to answer. It was the guys I hung out with back then, and we hated the Harley guys and their choppers and their whole attitude and that whole thing. We always felt like those guys gave motorcycles a bad name. And it seemed like the only logical way to go was the cafe racer. We didn't really know, and I've said this before, really know what it meant at the time. Kind of cafe racer, it's kind of a little self-explanatory, but we didn't know anything about the roots or the history. I didn't.
Yeah.
Right? We didn't have access to
like
all this stuff. But we knew low bars. What we modeled our bikes after, what we thought a cafe racer was modeling your bike after what you see the guys on the racetrack with.
So all those years when you were younger and you were building bikes, you'd never heard of the rockers? Like, you didn't know what the British rockers were and all of that?
Not at
all.
But
you're reading magazines, right? And you're seeing the track bikes. A little bit, right? And you're seeing like the solo seat and the
we were seeing
the bars and
we
everything.
Were seeing MotoGP and that type of racing, like GP racing and so
right.
on.
Which is what the British rockers modeled their bikes after.
That's what we were modeling.
Isle of Man races and stuff.
That's what we were.
So really, you had the same influences, but you didn't know that you were both doing
similar but different
things. Yeah.
I had no clue that on the other side of the pond they were doing that before us.
Yeah.
No, I had no clue.
That's kind of cool, though, because it really kind of speaks to the idea that influence wasn't taken from somebody who had taken the influence. It was like you were inspired by the racing bikes.
Yes, we were.
And you were trying to make them lean and fast like the racing
bikes.
Which is much cooler, I think, than Americans saying, oh, the British rockers are doing this and let's try and do the same thing. Kind of did it simultaneously, which is really cool, right?
That's why later on when I figured out what it was all about, I kind of liked the term American rocker. And I realized the American rocker is a different animal.
Yeah.
Than the British rocker, and we didn't follow in their footsteps. We kind of had our own pathway that we were taking. We were really emulating the race. We were emulating Rat Mamola and Kenny Roberts Dave Aldana and those guys. You know, I go on and on dropping names.
Sure.
But that's what we were. Yeah, that's what we were seeing.
And New Mexico has a great flat track history, right? We have some of the greats that lived out here.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you went to Speedway, right? As a kid, you saw all that.
I went one night to race. They closed the place down. I'm serious. I had borrowed this guy's little 175 Honda, and I was going to take it out there and just give it a shot, because you could do that back then, right?
Totally.
It was a $5 entry fee, and boom, you're in.
Steve McQueen, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. It's funny because, and I've said this before, you know, during the interview process for the documentary for Caffeine and Gasoline, which Ronnie is featured in, and Tyson's featured in, and that's how he got his name, Hollywood.
And Franco. Don't forget Sparky.
And Sparky is in there. It was interesting because I talked to, like, different people, and I don't want to mention names, but that consider themselves British rocker enthusiasts. And they were kind of down about the idea of an American rocker. And that rubbed me wrong, because the idea of the American rocker to me is somebody who took that racing aesthetic, made cafe racers, is American, and still had that same cafe racer aesthetic, right? That's what we are. We're Americans.
That's what
we did
are,
that. Yeah. That's what we aspire to build and race and do. So the term has to apply to us. We're not British. And you're American, right?
Oh, yeah. You can't call yourself a Brit.
Right, exactly.
If you're British, don't get offended, man. But, okay, so then if we go back to the historical side of it, because you've been in the bike scene longer than anybody else I know, right? When did you make that connection? And once you made that connection, what did you think about it?
I made that connection, I was probably about 14 or 15 years old, and I started cutting everything off of my little Honda and cutting the exhaust pipes off. There was even a neat little device called a snuffer nut. I don't know if anybody's heard of those things.
A
snuffer nut, you cut the pipe off and you put this little device in the end of the pipe. It's like a washer with a hole in it and a little tab on it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be riding down the street and you see a cop. You flip that thing with your foot.
That's great, dude.
No way. Oh, yeah. I've never heard of
it. You
flip
it
open again. Blammo! You're back to screaming Banshee. Yeah.
They make them now. They're cable controlled. So either up on the handlebars or even a car, you just flip a little lever.
Really?
It does the same thing. You'll throw a baffle on.
That's awesome.
Quiets it down.
Snuffer nut. They're too cool.
But you've also been in the Duke City Rockers quite a while. A little bit longer than I have. So at some point there was that connection and bridge, right? And do you want to talk about that and what made you decide to become a rocker and take it to that level?
Okay, well, that's an easy one. Back in the day, even when I'm talking back in the 70s, I'm riding around on my old RD, right?
Mm-hmm.
And God, that thing was beautiful. But anyways, I was always looking for other people that were doing the same thing to their motorcycles, right? I'll never forget, there were a couple of guys that had these beautiful cafe'd out Hondas. Never did cross paths with those guys, but I always wanted to, right? Just to tell them, dude, those bikes are awesome, right? Never cross paths with them. But I did run into, there was a small group of us, right, that rode them here in town, and that's how I got this ear piercing. That was our little thing. We didn't have a patch. We didn't have a name. We all wore a gold earring. One little golden hoop. That was our whole thing. The rest of it was our bikes, right? The rest of it was the bikes. It was all about bikes.
So instead of a gang jumped in, you got ear pierced instead.
So when I'm building those RDs, well, of course I'm thinking, there's got to be other people in town. There's got to be other people that are doing cafe racers there's just got to be, right? And one day Jerome is test riding one of them around the park, and all of a sudden I don't hear it anymore, so I start walking out in front of the house. Here he comes with this guy following behind him, and I'm going, oh shit, we're in trouble, right? He woke up the baby or grandma or something. They're coming to ask us to knock it off, right? Because, you know, they're loud and noisy and thinking the worst. And it turns out it was Fran. And Fran, I've got to introduce you to these guys. That was where I met Jeff and Caroline and Kevin Gick and Cody Cross. And Drew came later on, but yeah.
What year was that?
Well, let's see. Where are we now? That would have been going on the 9th rally, right? So yeah. It was 9 years ago now.
That's when you guys came together as kind of a group.
Yeah.
But had you seen any other cafe racers or vintage style bikes like that before then? That were doing what you were doing?
You mean before I ran into Jeff stuff? No, not really. Every now and then I'd be in the car with Michelle and I'd start screaming and freak her out, right? And it was because I saw some cafe bike, right? You know, some cafe racer. And she'd be like, why don't you just get a motorcycle? Anyways. Well, yeah.
The reason I ask is because, you know, I was thinking about this over the last week or so after the last podcast, and I was trying to remember when I started to see cafe racers. You know, not the modern, you know, classics that everybody's coming out with now, but like people actually taking their bike and chopping it again and making it a cafe racer in the last decade, you know what I mean? And I think the earliest I can remember is probably early 2000s. And I don't know, what do you guys think? You guys remember?
You know, I kind of think I've always seen them. They've always been around, but you know, unless you're looking for them, you're not going to see them, right? It's just another dude on a bike. But if you're into that, like I was back in the day, and whenever you see one, you're screaming in the car.
Yeah, because it's mostly choppers for the longest time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you go through phases, like Tyson was saying, you know, you go through the phase of, you know, choppers and then crotch rockets and whatever. But, you know, when cafe racers, style of cafe racer started to get, like, more obvious, like you start to see it, I think it was early 2000.
It's a tough thing to say because, again, when we look at, like, the history of American rockers, you know, we've had races throughout the United States where guys were flat-tracking bikes.
Oh, for sure.
You know, Triumphs and BSAs. Old Harleys, right? Old Ironheads. And, you know, if you look at those bikes today, you'd say, oh, that looks like a cafe racer, or that looks like a tracker, right?
Right.
And it pretty much essentially is the same thing. To a degree, but you never had guys with the cuffed jeans, I guess you could say, and the leather jackets. I mean, you had the Fonz and all that cool stuff, right?
No,
but they didn't take on the whole persona of a British cafe racer.
Yes, or
greaser tune-up guy, you know? And it never quite hit America that the American hot rod scene is here, and it, you know, it's an easy thing to mesh, but I don't think it ever really hit us like the British did, you know what I mean? Like, it hit the British.
Until now.
Until recently. But I mean, even if you look at like cafe racers now or trackers or the new modern bikes, it's not like the British, not the way the British do it.
No.
I don't think it ever will be.
No, it can't.
No, it definitely doesn't have that European look. Because even production bikes now, they don't look like a Triumph Thruxton or a Moto Guzzi V7.
No, look at like the second wave of like the Triumph Bonneville though. I mean, they did a pretty good job of replicating that. Yeah. Or, you know, the later version of the Bonneville came pretty darn close.
Well, and that's what I'm saying, is that the British bikes, the Triumphs and the Moto Guzzi's, Italian, their production cafe racers don't look like, the Japanese bikes don't look like these.
No.
Like those European bikes.
Which is interesting, you know, that's interesting too, because, you know, a couple of years ago, Honda was going to come out with another CV that kind of had that.
That retro look,
and it just didn't quite take off.
It's interesting because it's funny that you say that, because I was looking online, I was trying to find some research on it, and they had coined a term that was called neo-retro. Mm-hmm. Honda did this just like 6 months ago.
Oh, wow.
And they released this little teaser video, and it turned out what they were really promoting was the CB1000R, which is, you know, it's still a modern take on the cafe racer, but it's interesting because it's like very close, you know? It's a production bike. It's not a cafe racer in the truest sense of the word.
No.
I would call that, looking at the 2018 model, that looks more like an FZ08.
Or like a Buell almost.
Or like a Buell almost, yeah. It has that.
Or like the BMW. You could look at the new BMW that came out. And
it's the same thing, the R9T, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're beautiful bikes, and they have the aesthetic.
Even when I had that XS750, the first thing I did was pull the handlebars off and throw them away and put drag bars on it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, which brings up the whole sort of, and you probably know this, you know, more than we do, Ronnie, being around that scene for so long and racing and emulating those early racers. You know, where do you sort of draw the line between like the real American rocker and the style, you know, like content versus just style, you know? Everybody's putting out a production bike now that's, you know, a modern classic reissue type thing, but where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line? I mean, you've been doing this a long time.
I guess I don't really know what you mean. Like,
if you go out and you buy a brand new R90 BMW, right? And you ride it around and you have the cafe racer aesthetic, does that, to you, feel like the same thing?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, you mean some new bike that's made with a retro design?
Yeah.
No, that's not what it's about. It's about taking that bike, and you know what? Even though it has that retro design, I'll bet you there's 30, 50 pounds of garbage I could throw off of that bike and make that bike go faster, right? And I'd throw those junky-ass pipes away off of the fucking thing, and I'd put real clip-ons on that damn thing, right?
Yeah.
And I'd put real rear sets on that thing, and I'd get rid of that big, fat, bushy, poofy seat. It doesn't need that shit, right? That's not... Now it's a cafe race. When you get rid of that shit, and you're going to pull extra horsepower out of that thing because you lowered the weight ratio.
Right.
Right? Boom. There you go. Now you can call it a cafe race.
Right.
But rolling off the showroom floor?
Yeah.
No. No. Yeah. To put it nicely, no.
I want to go off that. That's why they don't make like your RD350 anymore, any two-strokes.
Well, two-strokes are the EPA, too.
Yeah, the EPA. That's like going off the...
So they can eat my smoke, right?
Yeah, exactly. Talking about pulling off the mufflers and all that fun stuff. Yep, that's exactly why.
That's why.
Mm-hmm.
Did you look at the what they're trying to call the... RD350 Resurrection.
Oh, yeah, the new one.
The XSR 300.
Yeah. XSR, and then they have the 900.
And the same thing. It looks like just like a naked sport bike, like all the other ones right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And really, if you look at that thing, what are they ripping off? What design? What look is that? The Seika.
That is the Seika.
That's a Seika look.
Oh, yeah. It's just like Seika tank.
Seika style.
Yep.
The style that when the Yamaha first came out with the Seika look, everybody hated it. They said it was the ugliest thing on earth. And then 3 years later, Honda, Suzuki, and Kawasaki are all doing it, and they're selling like hotcakes.
Yeah.
And Yamaha had discontinued the look because it was so sourly received, right?
Yeah.
And now it's coming back as a retro look.
You know, I got to say, I like the look of all of those bikes. They're beautiful bikes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with, like, trying to promote that style and feel because it keeps... that vintage style alive, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is pretty cool.
If you grasp the interest of a new generation of riders, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, yeah. So from that standpoint, I think it's cool.
But after they've dropped it and beat it and it's not so pretty anymore, then it's time to start cutting it up. And
I think in 20 years, it's going to be really cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
If we still have gas-powered bikes.
Well, that's absolutely. True. Can you imagine the Cafe Racer CBR?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Well, I mean, that's essentially... Well, not to, like, you know, downplay the crotch rocket guys out there, but that's essentially what they're doing with those Street Fighter bikes.
Yeah, that's right.
What
Street Fighter,
they're taking their crotch rockets or their 900s or DSXR and they're stripping them down.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cool. It's not my thing or our thing, but, I mean, it's kind of like the modern cafe.
But it's what we were doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's just the modern version.
It's the concept's the same, for sure.
Yeah.
And not to pick on, like, Joe, but his bike kind of borders that Street Fighter Cafe Racer because it's a newer bike. But he threw the round headlight on. Tried to keep that as an old style cafe racer.
Yeah.
But because it's a newer bike, especially the tank, it just lends itself more towards a street fighter. So he's kind of towing that line.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is cool because he's breaking some kind of new ground there,
Definitely.
Which is, you know, that's the cafe racer. aesthetic, exactly right? Just trying to do something new.
He's,
cool.
He's chopped and hacked the shit out of
it. Yeah. I love that.
He rides that bike like a wild Apache, man.
Yeah, he does.
You know, Tyson kind of touched on it when we veered away, but we were talking about the Dead City Rockers, and you hooking up with those guys. It was Jeff Korn and...
Chorn? Not Korn.
No, it's Korn.
It's Korn.
Is it Jefferson's Korn? It's Jefferson Korn.
No, it's Korn.
It's Korn. Oh,
Jefferson
wow.
Korn.
I didn't know that.
And Jeff will correct you.
It's Korn.
He'll probably get a message after this podcast.
Jeff, it's Korn. We know it's Korn. And who else was in that? There was
Jeff and Fran and Caroline and
Kevin.
Kevin.
Kinda. Dan.
Kind of.
Dan Mayfield a little bit.
Dan, yeah. A guy, a fellow named Cody Cross. And there was, what was the other... anyways, there were a couple other
folks. Was there like five or ten of you guys?
That were random in the thing. Maybe, ten of us. Jerome, of course, was hanging out with us, too.
And were you an officer? Did you guys...
No. Things weren't to that at that point yet. Jeff was kind of a fearless leader, right? Mm-hmm. As far as organizing in a group and what have you, and putting meetings together and stuff.
That was 9 years ago.
Yeah.
Almost a decade ago, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then it went, and the Duke City Rockers became a pretty big group for a while, which was like in the 14, 15 members, right?
Maybe even bigger.
At some point, some bigger.
Probably about 20. Yeah.
Which kind of mirrored the interest nationally in cafe racers, right?
Yeah.
Like, they started to become bigger around the country. Started to see them in advertising, started to see them in commercials and movies. Mm-hmm. You know, vintage cafe racers, which is really cool. And now, you guys think we've hit a pinnacle? Cafe racers.
I hope not.
Does it matter, though? I mean, really?
No, I'm just curious.
I mean, I think it's the same thing that we've talked about. Like, what are our core values as vintage enthusiasts or cafe racers, and it's kind of that same idea that we come back to always, and it's the idea of like wrenching together and being a family together, and you know, who cares if it's mainstream at this point, right?
No, it doesn't. I don't care from our standpoint whether it's popular or not. I'm just curious in the cultural spectrum,
aspect
is it, has it peaked or has it not? I've read some really interesting articles that people are saying no, it's still full steam. That's why we're seeing these modern classic, you know, production bikes coming out.
I believe they may be right. I think it may be still full steam. I'm thinking about just the younger people that we've started running into and them showing up at our rides and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are they showing up on vintage bikes or production bikes?
You know what's funny? A lot of them that show up on the production bikes are really vintage, right?
See, that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Well, I think it probably peaked in popularity maybe a couple of years ago when, I guess, with the hipster craze. Mm-hmm. Everyone, like, that's why cafes start kind of getting a bad name because, oh, you want an old bike? Oh, you're a hipster. Well, I think now it's kind of, it's not cool anymore. It's less cool. So people who want their cafe racers are the guys who actually want to have an old vintage cafe racer.
Well, I mean,
a wrench on it.
You guys probably saw that too. Is that, you know, I don't want to say a bunch of kids, but there was a bunch of, you know, younger people going out and they're getting CBs, you know, fives and sevens that were still pretty affordable at that point, or even sporties, right? And they're chopping them up and sometimes not doing the best job at chopping them up.
Yeah.
And then basically once all those bikes were bought up and chopped up, what do you do next?
Yeah.
Right? So you go to a modern classic. Mm-hmm. You know, and unfortunately what it did is it kind of destroyed the vintage market to a degree. But those guys that were still holding on to those Triumphs, BSAs, maybe even BMWs, Steve, they knew what they were worth, and they weren't going to sell them on the cheap end, right?
Yeah.
And let some kid come in and just chop them up.
Yeah, no, not anymore.
It wasn't going to happen. Yeah.
Because 8 or 9 years ago, when I first got into this, my CB 750 was a dual red cam. It was, I think, an 81. Mm-hmm. I bought a pair of them for $400 out in El Paso.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Yeah, you can't do it.
No way. No. I did the same thing. I could pick up a CB 750 running with Tidal for $250-$300 and then in the course of over what, 2-3 years, it was like everybody wanted $2,500-$3,500 for the same bike, which you know, it's great that it's worth that or if you can get that for it, but it really changed the dynamic of the bike that you can pick up and what you can do with
it. But you don't see those
the
RDs
stock,
no, you never
like
see
that
RDs.
You don't see those RDs
the stock
like that.
And in good running condition RD according to the Blue Book right now can be worth as much as $7,000. Those things sold for brand new. They were selling for $800, dude, back in the 70s.
Oh, heck, man. That's when I saw that 69 R3 for $500. I'm calling this guy right now. I think I was in the middle of like Artesia or something like that. Barely any service, but I'm like trying to text him, call him. And yeah, so
What'd you pick up?
That 69 R3, Yamaha R3, the one before Ronnie's R5.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And I know I was trying to do some research on it. There's very little information about the old R3s. But I guess the R3 and the R1, they were legit race bikes that they slapped on street legal.
Yes, they were.
Headlight and instrumentation. So here you go.
Yes, they were.
That's whereas the RD was more of a streetable bike.
RD was the first one with the reed valves.
Yep.
As soon as they put reed valves in it,
that
toned it down.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, which is incredible to say it toned down because you could crack the throttle and raise the front end in first, second, and third gear on those babies. And
oh, man, I know.
And that's toned down, right? So, yeah.
Give me a couple weeks. I'll have that R3 running, man. We'll kill ourselves on it. We'll see what happens with that. Drum brakes.
Oh, they're a hoot, dude.
Yeah, drum with a two-stroke.
Yep, two-stroke.
That'll be great. Man. It sounds safe.
What some of the guys would do is take those R3 or R5 350, right, and put a 250 tranny on it. You know why? The gear ratio is tighter. And you're not going to get the top speed out of it. Mm-hmm. You can by changing your sprocketing, right? But it's hot, dude. It's hot, hot.
Jump right off the line.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They're ridiculous. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. I think we all kind of feel that the culture aspect of it is going strong still. You know, and I think I personally think the younger generation of kids that are getting into bikes are not looking at production bikes as much. That's just my opinion. I see them looking at old dirt bikes now, you know, making scramblers, making
trackers,
flat trackers, doing that type of thing, which I get excited about. I think that's really cool. Kids getting into dirt bikes and making, you know, that kind of...
It's something that may be a big factor that... we had that they're not getting. We in the old days of Wide World of Sports, they would show GP racing. They would follow that. You could watch it on Sundays,
Sunday morning
on TV, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And now it's not there. You can't find it. I talked to people at work about going to MotoGP, and they're, what the hell is that?
Yeah,
they have no idea.
It's true.
Right? It's like, oh, okay, well. You know, lost civilization, aren't we?
Yeah, you know, and one thing that we haven't really talked about that I think is really cool is a lot of young women and girls are getting into the dirt bike aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I talked to a girl today that is, you know, showed me her Suzuki 125 that she takes out on the Mesa. You know, here in New Mexico, it's all desert Mesa out there. You can go ride for hours.
Oh, yeah.
And it's exciting. You know, my daughter, 14-year-old daughter asked me, you know, when am I going to teach her how to ride a dirt bike? That's cool, you know? That excites me, the idea of them wanting to get into it. And if that generation stays with that, I think at some point they get into street bikes, right? Because they want to get around town. So, you know, you're probably going to start with something you can afford, which is how most of us get into vintage bikes, because at least at that point you can get them fairly cheap and do something cool with them, you know?
Well, like my wife, she has her 89, 88 Sportster 1200, and that's been in her family. That's her bike. She loves that thing. But it just doesn't compare to her Ural. Because you could hop in that Ural even and just go anywhere. You could take it up camping, boat out that sidecar, go everywhere, and it'd be all of a sudden be a dirt bike.
Yeah.
I remember meeting Franco and her, and Diana was riding the bike, and Franco was always in the sidecar.
that's where I got.
A modern man.
He is a modern man, yeah, for sure.
Hey, man, when you can kick back, like on a long trip.
And drink a beer.
But putting your headphones and watching Netflix while someone's riding, just kind of chill, maybe take a nap.
Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with
that,
man.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, great. That sounds great.
Well, and then once I got kicked out, Celia, our dog, started riding in. He had his goggles and everything. I think he misses that bike.
Yeah.
So we're definitely going to pick another one up. Got to find one.
Yeah, those old Urals are getting harder to find.
Yeah, the new ones, man. The new ones are fantastic. They're just an arm and a leg.
I remember when you guys were selling that. I was like, oh, my God, I need to get this bike.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, they're out there. You just have to find them. There's one over here in downtown. I want to go talk to them, see if they sell it.
Same year?
Yeah, it looks about the same.
It's down on 12th Street?
Yep, the green one.
I pass
one.
That thing all the time. It's always parked.
The green one is parked. Yep. Dude, that bike never moves.
I need to save a little cash. And
have you actually talked to the guy?
Hey, dude, if you're listening to this podcast,
hit us up, please. Yeah. The tires look a little rough, bud.
Yeah, well, it's been sitting there.
It's okay. Three wheels. One blows you up, too.
Yeah, exactly.
They're the best thing about the Ural is that spare tire that was on the back
right.
can mount on anyone. Can mount on the sidecar, can be a front tire or a back tire. It was all universal. Mm-hmm. That was the coolest part about that bike. Everything was meant to be
take apart,
fixed with a screwdriver and a wrench.
Nice. Now that's the way
that
to do it.
That is cool.
Well, Ron, thanks for sitting around and talking with us.
My pleasure.
And having some, what are you drinking, man?
Lagunitas IPA.
Yeah?
That's his favorite.
It's Ronnie's favorite.
That's what he's really drinking.
Food of the gods. Right?
And if you're ever in the Southwest, look for a little guy on an orange RD, man. You can't miss him. Blowing smoke all over the place.
Yeah. He's like the local RD legend. All you see is this blue smoke and little red or orange RD flying down the road. Mm-hmm.
It might be another color in a couple of years.
Well, that's true.
No.
I'm sticking with it.
I like the orange and green. Cantaloupe colors. Orange and green, man.
Well, awesome, Ron. It's always great talking to you.
Thanks, guys.
People, hopefully, will get to see you in the documentary when it comes out. Ron Senna featured in there. We're going to be doing something a little bit different in the next episode. We're going to be talking to some musicians and getting their take on vintage and rockabilly culture and stuff. A friend of ours, Eddie Brewer, and his guitar player, Danny Pohl. So we hope you all liked this little episode of the podcast, and we'll talk to you next time. See you later, Sparky.
See you later, Sparky.
Tyson.
Adios, guys.
Ronnie.
Pleasure to be here. See you all around.
We'll see you later.
Down the way, not too far, an old-time rockabilly coffee bar. Record machine tucked in the back. Elvis singing about a Cadillac. I'm on a BSA. Been riding all day. Leather's on, goggles too. Triumphant, I don't know what you wanna do. My baby's on a Vincent, has been for quite a while. She said it's rocking just her style.
So let's ride,
so let's ride,
so let's ride,
so let's ride.
Come on, turn up, I got love the cams. American rocker, as a matter of fact.